to the 222nd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome. It has been raining in Southwest Florida. The grass is very green, but the sky is very cloudy and wet, making training a little bit difficult. We're in the second week of the August Birthday Challenge with all of you out there, so I hope you're doing well. This is the second time in 1 week that I got sirened out of the pool during Masters swim class because of thunder. The storms that are supposed to be rolling in, you know, and a couple hours later, been rolling in very quickly. So I'm spending more time on my bike trainer inside than outside. Have managed to get my runs inside. Still doing some speed work on the treadmill, using the treadmill to do my hills. I am also, what day is it? It is the 16th straight day of planks for me, so I'm doing two-a-days on planks, a session in the morning and a session in the evening, so hopefully that's going to help my core strength for the Ironman. So things are going good, knock on wood, so far so good, doing one strength training session a week, along with the swim, bike, running. Again, the swimming is going to have to increase here if the weather will cooperate here pretty soon. So anyway, it is what it is. So doing some dry land. I have some bands. I do some simulations of stroke that way. But, you know, nothing is good to feel the water like feeling the water. So hopefully I'll get back in the pool Monday and get back at it. If you have signed up for the Wellness Challenge, Addie Delaney Meinrich has sent an email newsletter out with suggested workouts for the week. So if you're having trouble or you want to do something different, make sure you open the newsletter that we sent out so that you can have those workouts to add to what you're doing or, you know, again, just change things up a little bit. There's a lot of dietary information and diet wars. If you go on social media, if you go on the web and go to people's website, people talk about ketogenic diet and paleo diet and vegan diet and plant-based diet and Whole30 diet and anti-inflammatory diet and all different kinds of ways that are basically... Most of them are looking at ways for people to lose weight. But when we talk about a whole food plant-based diet, we're talking about how to live optimally the longest that you can without any impairments. So there's a couple studies that I'd like to talk to or talk about today that, you know, kind of go along with this, and a couple things that I've run into over the past week. Somebody came into the office and said that carbohydrates caused high blood pressure. And I asked them, you know, how could carbohydrates possibly cause high blood pressure? What would be the mechanism? And they didn't have an answer. And, you know, we blindly follow people that seem to have some sort of training or background or claim to fame or expert attached to their name, or maybe they look good and you want to look like them. But you have to stop and ask, what's the mechanism of all this and what's the long-term health? And I looked at some of the recipes she was paying a monthly membership for, and, you know, they included tremendous amounts of salt and oil and meat, and they were high fat and they were low in carbohydrate, but she could have fruit. So it didn't make complete sense. It didn't follow a paleo diet completely. It certainly didn't follow a ketogenic diet. It was just haphazard. And it turns out, you know, about the only thing that I could figure out was there was a study that looked at a high carbohydrate diet that could cause an actual drop in blood pressure in elderly people if they were acutely given this big carbohydrate load. And the mechanism for that is that when you eat an elderly person would eat a very high carbohydrate load, and a lot of blood is diverted to the gut. And so if the blood is diverted to the gut, it's going more places and the blood pressure can drop. The compensatory mechanism for that is the heart rate should increase and the heart contractility should increase. And actually the peripheral vessels should squeeze to counteract those mechanisms. But in the elderly, sometimes the heart rate doesn't go up and their heart, its function is not good enough to increase the contraction. And so they can get a low blood pressure after they would have a high carbohydrate meal. But that's certainly the exception more so than the rule. And the idea would be to, you know, not have a very large meal if you were an elderly person, and it only makes sense. But nevertheless, this was taken and twisted around as that carbohydrates are bad. And it's, you know, just certainly not so. But if you look at risk factors, the American Heart Association came up with or looked at these seven risk factors. And they looked at the risk factors at 50, and then they looked at vascular health. Two decades later, they also looked at the incidence of dementia. And, you know, they were, what you, you know, at midlife or 50, what's your blood pressure? What's your cholesterol? Is it under good control? Is your glucose normal? Are you active? Active being, you know, probably the 100, we'll define that as 150 minutes three times a week. Do you eat a good diet? That was, you know, low in animal products, but not vegan by any stretch of the imagination, just low in red meat and a lower fat diet. So no real guidelines. Was your weight within a normal BMI, and did you smoke? So just by doing those, they came up with a cardiovascular health score, and they divided them out 0 to 6. If you had, you know, 6 of those things were under control, was poor cardiovascular health score. If you have 7 to 11, that would be a good cardiovascular health score, and the optimal would be if you had 12 to 14 of those 7 things together, that would be an optimal score. And if you had an optimal score, that correlated with increased brain volume and gray matter at 70 by MRI, as well as increased vascular reactivity at an earlier age, or I'm sorry, at a later age, and they looked at 2 decades later. So if we look at another kind of diet, you know, so if we look at what diet would be to help explain this, you know, a plant-based diet, we like people to have 4 to 5 cups of greens a day. So that would be nitric oxide producing things like kale, Swiss chard, collards, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, beets, beet tops, mustard greens, broccolini, and so forth. And that causes nitric oxide production and dilates the arteries, and so that's going to help control your blood pressure. So that's a great thing. If you're on a ketogenic diet, you can have about 1 cup of kale a day for your total carbohydrates. If you're on a paleo diet, you can have a little bit more in the way of greens, but certainly not 4 to 5 cups of greens plus anything else. You know, looking at cholesterol, only animal products have cholesterol in them. We know the ketogenic diet and paleo diet will increase your total cholesterol, increase triglycerides, so that certainly is not going to get you where you want to go. Over the long period of time, your glucose may be down on a ketogenic diet because you're not taking glucose in, but you're not improving glucose tolerance. We know that by taking a high-fat diet, and you're actually blocking the liver and blocking the muscle cell uptake glucose with fat. Fat is causing the problem. So you're not seeing an elevated glucose when you're not taking in glucose, but when you break that and actually have some glucose, you're going to see a big rise in glucose. So there, you know, you're, unless you can stay on this diet forever, which nobody has proven that they can yet, they're going to be in problems. That's why everybody has a cheat day. And so those cheat days are going to have high glucoses. Weight, optimal body mass index. That's an interesting thing that we've discussed with people this week. You know, can I ever get to a normal body mass index? Is that normal for me? And you know, if we look at the change in the average weight of women over the last, I think I looked at from 1960 to 2000, it's gone from an average weight of 140 to the average weight of a woman's 166. The average weight of a guy was 166, gone to 197, 198. So what we see as normal today is not the normal of yesteryear, but the body mass index that we're looking for that roughly correlates with decreased visceral fat mass is that, you know, 18.5 to 24.5, roughly. There are a few men out there that are very muscular, that may have be able to tolerate an increased body mass index. But as people get older, especially, you know, after 35, and once you hit 50, 60, you lose muscle mass and bone mass yearly, so the chance of you having a lot of muscle mass at 50 is probably not, you know, it's certainly not going to go up from what you had for the most part. So you're carrying a lot of fat mass, which corresponds to a lot of visceral fat mass, and there's actually been studies looking at women, and unfortunately, women with a normal BMI, 24.8, 24.9, can actually have a lot more fat mass if you look by MRI and actually look at the visceral fat. So even a fat mass, if your body, it comes down to body composition. So if you're carrying a lot of weight in the midsection, you know, you may actually have more visceral fat, and the BMI of 24.8 might be too high. On the other hand, if somebody's very muscular, you know, somebody's a cyclist or a weightlifter that has big legs and carry a lot of muscle, then they may get away with a body mass index that's higher. We do know that, you know, it's hard to carry that mass over time, regardless, even if it's muscle mass, it takes its toll on in general health and metabolic and metabolism and metabolic waste. So, the leaner, smaller person is definitely at an advantage. But if you, look at these diets just as a way to maintain weight, then, you know, possibly you can. But, you know, we see most people that try a low-carbohydrate diet, they end up falling off and going over and then gaining more weight. So it ends up being, at best, a yo-yo. And, you know, I think that if you have a lot of weight to lose, I think it's probably better not to focus on that number so much as focus on eating healthy. And if you're eating a really whole food plant-based diet without any extra oil, that weight's going to gradually come off of you and you'll shrink up and everything will work out. So it's not so much of a focus on weight as it is actually getting your nutrients in line. We know that people that, if you're eating a lot of oil or a lot of fats, that can cause vasoconstriction or constriction of the blood vessels, also leading to high blood pressure. So that's, you know, again, where a plant-based diet is going to be protective because we're not getting in the extra oils. Certainly replacing saturated fat with polyunsaturated fats is better, but is by no means a way to reverse disease or to eliminate cardiovascular disease or decrease it. So we want people to get off the processed oils as much as possible. So there's no need for olive oil or any kind of yellow fluids added to food as a source of a health. It's not needed. It's hard to get away from sometime if you're out and you're traveling because people put it in and it's in everything. It's in as a preservative. It makes things softer. But it's not necessary. It's not necessary in bread. It's not necessary in cooking. It's not necessary in a salad dressing. It can be completely eliminated, and you'll be just fine. And then obviously there's no real need to smoke. There was a thing that came out that, you know, this vaping actually has led to, it's almost a gateway to cigarette smoking or rebound into smoking. It's by no means the cure. And again, you're inhaling nicotine and chemicals. How could that possibly be good? So, you know, don't fall for any of those tricks. Get off the inhaled substances. We can look all the way back to the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in 1999 that looked at fiber intake, vitamin C, and beta-carotene. And they looked at 5,287 subjects with colon cancer and 10,470 people without, compared them, and they looked at their fiber intake and the beta-carotene and the vitamin C intake, and as we know, fiber intake, the higher the fiber intake, the less risk of cancer. And if, you know, it was postulated all the way back then that there would be a 31% decrease in colon cancer if people increased their average fiber intake by 13 grams. And that's about 70% increase back at that time. So you can figure that, you know, the average American diet, if you look at the people eating standard American diet, eat about 10 to 12 grams of fiber on a good day. If you're eating a ketogenic diet, you're getting probably less fiber than that. So the risk of colon and rectal cancer, has been shown to markedly go up over time. So again, you know, no matter how skinny you are, if your cancer risk is going up, then why do it? I heard someone talk that they're developing a website, kind of like a personal data bank that you can take care of your own health care. It's going to be your own doctor, so you can, you know, order tests from this website. You can store all your medical data in this website, or get, you know, information or feedback on your metrics or your numbers. And the question comes, you know, what numbers should we be looking at, and should we be focused on numbers? You know, I've done a lot of podcasts talking about how we focus on, as physicians, focus on numbers, but we're really not helping the patient by how we're treating those numbers. And I got an email today asking me, you know, about these health scan tests. Should, you know, for $135, you can get your carotids and your abdominal aorta and an echocardiogram by these mobile services. And, you know, should everybody do that? You know, you can even open it up to say, should everybody go get a calcium score? And I know a lot of people out there think that, you know, you should get a calcium score. And you know, there's a lot of other screening things. And the idea is if you have a negative one of these, if you have a negative test, are you immune from the disease? And if you are immune, how long are you immune from the disease? And, you know, we can start by looking at stress tests. Stress tests will detect a blockage of greater than 70%, but it doesn't detect blockages less than that, specifically 20-30% blockages that may be soft, unstable plaques that can rupture. So you hear people talk about, I had a stress test and it was negative, and then the next day I had a heart attack. You know, those are not often occurring things, but they certainly do happen because we're not picking up those unstable lesions. And frankly, there's nothing that can be done mechanically if you have a 30% blockage. And if we looked at every person over 65, we would find the majority of people had these 30%. They're walking around with these 30% blockages. And, you know, what do you do with them medically or mechanically? You know, they're certainly not, it's too risky to stent all those blockages. You know, they're, like I said, they can be everywhere. So you can't find them all and stent them all. So, you know, what are we doing with the stress test other than saying to that day that, you know, everything was somewhat fine? When we put people on have people walk on a treadmill test, if they can walk 10 or 12 minutes, that gives us good prognostic information in that their functional capacity or their ability to exercise and their aerobic fitness is very good. And that's an excellent prognostic indicator, despite the rest of the information as far as nuclear imaging or the like. Often the nuclear imaging, it's a source of significant radiation. So is, you know, the PET scanning, and if they PET nuclear imaging, and oftentimes there can be falsely positive. So there's perhaps something going on that there's a risk or not. So the next step would be heart catheterization. So what are you going to do with the information? So before you sign up for a stress test, it's what do you want to do for the information? If you want to see what your functional capacity is, or if you want to see whether you may have arrhythmias, you're having some symptoms of some sort, but if you're completely asymptomatic and you're in good physical condition, it may not be you may not get any more information. And certainly with a nuclear imaging test, you may cause more harm than good. If you have an abnormal stress, you'll be forced into or, you know, strongly encouraged to get a catheterization. It carries 1% risk of stroke, heart attack, or death that you didn't have before you walked in there. So that's not necessarily the better choice. So it's, you know, to do test on everybody without ever thinking about what am I going to do with this information, or is that person symptomatic, or are they at significant risk that we need to know, is the first question that should be asked. Not just that, you know, everybody that walks through the door should have these tests. If you go look at these scans, you know, that come by the mobile van and you go in and you get these scans, well, a lot of them are operator dependent. If you're cranking them out at $135 a pop, somebody's cranking them all out in 10 minutes, they're doing a quick look that may lead to information that's not accurate, which may lead to further invasive testing. Who needs those scans? Again, if somebody's at risk, high cholesterol, they've had maybe a TIA-type symptom, or you know, their blood pressure's high, then maybe it's worth looking. But the question should be, what am I going to do with the information? How is it going to change things? Am I going to use that information to change my lifestyle more? If I see carotid plaques, am I going to really dial back my diet? Is that going to drive me to do something differently? You know, quite frankly, I see a lot of people that have, you know, bypass procedures, and as soon as the bypass scars heal, they're back to doing what they did before. As soon as the pain's gone, it's, you know, the change is no longer there. So is having an abnormal scan, does that cause enough pain to make great changes? I don't know. If you're following, you know, if you want to look year to year to see if something is getting better, you're making progress, that may be a reason to do it. But, the question always comes, so what are you going to do with the information? Are you going to go for a more invasive procedure? Or are you going to stop? Are you going to change lifestyle factors? I think that's the first question that needs to be done. And just because something might be cheap and you don't know the accuracy of it, it might not be the reason to do. If it's, so I think that's the main thing that people need to look at is what do you really want to do with the information? Do you want to expose yourself to radiation just because? And when it comes to a nuclear stress or a calcium score test, will that really cause? If you're a plant-based and you're whole foods, and you're doing the best that you possibly can, how would that possibly change? Same way with blood tests. I got asked about a methylmalonic acid test. That blood test is used or has been postulated to be a reason to test for B12 deficiency. And as all your friends have told you, when you go to a vegan diet, it's a bad diet because you could be B12 deficient. You have, there's no vegan sources of B12 for the most part. Nutritional yeast is. B12 comes from bacteria in the soil, and the animals eat the soil, and you eat the animals, and that was the way people traditionally got B12. So you can do a blood test to see what your B12 levels is. The normalist range in the laboratory is 200 to 1,000. But we know, and B12, if your B12 level is greater than 400, there's no real risk of any kind of deficiency. It's going to be effective. There is a problem with intrinsic factor, or if people are on H2 blockers or protein, H2 like Zantac or Pepcid, or proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole, they can actually impair the breakdown of B12 from the protein it's connected to. And so even though you're taking in B12, you might not absorb it. But your blood test would show, so if your blood test is over 400, then you're good. There can be a problem with the parietal cells in your stomach that you lack the intrinsic factor to do the absorption, or have it autoimmune diseases can actually impair them. But there's another mechanism of B12 absorption that doesn't involve the intrinsic factor. So many years ago, the study was done giving people oral B12 versus the intramuscular injection, and the oral B12 actually did better. They had more consistent levels and got to the normal level over time. So there's absolutely no indication whatsoever for intramuscular B12 just because. Now, if somebody has an acute, very low level, and they're symptomatic, yes, intramuscular injection. So if somebody's very malnourished, they come in maybe detoxing from alcoholism, and their mental status is very impaired, then a shot of B12 would be warranted. But to get B12 intramuscularly on a monthly basis because you don't have a normal level and you're walking around and it's just a little low, you don't need to have that done. You can take it orally. So, and there's places in the mall now that have been opened up that you can go in and get B12 injected. Absolute nonsense. Don't waste your money. Take your B12. Typically, people do 3,000 micrograms of methylcobalamin and five times a week. They're going to be fine. If you do nutritional yeast, you might even need less. You should have your B12 checked to make sure you're over 500, but if you're over the 400 to 500 range, you're good. If you're less than 100, or you're in that 100 to, if you're less than 100, you're B12 deficient and you need to have it replaced. If you're in the 100 to 400 range, methyl malonic acid might be elevated because that's part of the step. Methyl malonic acid, B12 is used in the chemical reaction to turn that into succinyl coenzyme A. So your methyl malonic acid will increase. Same way with homocysteine and folic acid uses B12 to be converted into methionine. So you need B12. So your homocysteine levels may be elevated. So if somebody has a homocysteine level that's elevated, it's a marker for cardiovascular disease and premature atherosclerosis. And so the next step would be look at someone's B12. But the studies looking at methyl malonic acid to see if you're B12 deficient in the presence of normal B12 is not indicated, and it's not going to really do much. So it's one of those blood tests that, again, on some of these websites, people say, oh, you should test it, but really there's no good proof that it's needed, or really it can be falsely positive and, you know, confuse the issue even more. You can have impaired B12 absorption if you have intestinal overgrowth. If you have Crohn's disease, you know, some parasites, you know, tapeworm, that can all cause problems. But, in today's society, the H2 blockers and the protein pump inhibitors are some of the biggest reasons. And the other thing is people that eat a standard American diet are eating factory-farmed animals that are also B12 deficient. So that can be a cause as well. But there's no, other than having your B12 tested, there's no reason to go to the mall and get B12 infused. So, I mean, it comes down to the most important thing is what are you going to do with the results of the tests that you're taking or subjecting yourself to or the metrics that you're collecting? If they don't really, if you're not going to do anything to change it, then, you know, why look at it? If you're doing the best you can, then, you know, is it going to make that much difference? Is the risk versus the benefit? You know, I think everybody needs their cholesterol check to see where they are. Again, it's one of those 7 risk factors, and we need a blood pressure check, but we have to do something with the information. And just treating the number to make the number normal by some means is not always with a medicine is not necessarily the ultimate way to turn things around. So I think, I think it's really a good idea to look at these 7 indices and, diet and activity and your weight is going to go a long way to helping you maintain your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and your glucose. So focusing on those are some of the best metrics that you can deal with. Today in our level 3 nutrition class, part of the discussion was on a book called Meatonomics. And it's actually a great book looking at the external costs of eating meat and somewhat depressing, you know, when you look at it, it kind of reads like a thriller novel. A lot of our government subsidies goes to the meat industry or to farms that make soy, genetically modified soybeans and genetically modified corn to feed the animals. And the reality of it is if we use that area of land to grow vegetables, we could feed everybody in the world and not have to worry about anybody starving. The cost of a McDonald's or a fast food hamburger or cheeseburger is the same as it was 15 years ago, yet the price of vegetables go up, and it's largely because of subsidies and external costs that are put onto society. People that are eating fast foods, eating the standard American diet, are becoming much more sick. They're going to the hospital. The hospital's charging big prices. Everybody has to have insurance. The prices are inflated and negotiated. Money's made by doing procedures, testing, and we're kidding everybody that, we're making a difference by doing these prophylactic tests and giving these medications, when the reality of it is we're not, much healthier than we were 30 years ago, probably less healthy when it comes to our children. And, it's all a big vicious cycle that continues to go on. And even though we're plant-based people, We're part of the, the train as far as, we're paying for our insurance and we're paying for our health care and we're paying for other people's smoking and eating and poor choices and McDonald's choices and things are continuing to be subsidized. And, we're such a minority, as the world messed up to the point of no return. And I guess I kind of left people, and I apologize to anybody that's in class today. Maybe it's a little bit too negative, because I think that, as plant-based people that are eating fruits and vegetables, I think, one, our health, the best thing that we can do is maintain our health and maintain the health of our families. And when it comes down to it, that's really all that matters. I thought today of all the things that I've given my daughter, education and travel or vacations or whatever I've given her through the years, the best thing that I ever gave her was the desire to be plant-based. And so, at 27 now, she's been plant-based for many years. And, her health risk is markedly decreased even over mine by starting at such a young age. And, we talked about, if you have children or grandchildren, in my eye, it's a sin to give little kids dairy with the increasing the risk of autoimmune diseases and, cancer later in later stages, especially girls and the breast cancer risk, because we can do so much to prevent things if we start out early and keep this metabolic waste down. So I think the reality of it is, as plant-based people, we're in the driver's seat. We may be small, but it's a very, we have our health, we have energy, we have the insight to try to make our lives and better each day. And we're setting a good example for others. People may, a lot of people don't necessarily want to hear it, but it doesn't really matter because you're actually doing the right thing. And the best thing that you can do is to pass it on to the people that you love and not support the standard industries that are supporting this, vicious cycle. So, stay away from those places that are serving products that are harming the environment. Don't change, your dinner. Don't bring animal products into your house when you have company come in. If they want to, eat that way before or after or not come, that's okay. But I think that you make good food, you make healthy food, you don't have to call it vegan food or plant-based food. You make fruit and vegetables and grains, whole grains, and it's good food and people will eat it. And it's colorful and it's beautiful and enjoy it and be thankful for it. And when you can pay a little bit more for a farmer that's planting an organic crop or a farmer that's maybe not organically certified, but it's local and you know where it comes from, he's not using pesticides, then pay a little bit more so that you can support those people that are doing the right thing. So buy local, eat seasonal, focus on getting those seven steps down, getting your fiber, 50, 70 grams of fiber a day. Focus on teaching your children the right way to eat. And, don't compromise your principles for anyone. When you go out to dinner, demand that you get what you need to eat or don't eat because it's not helping you, it's not helping the environment, it's not helping the system. So as, if the 4% of us that are plant-based or vegan continuously do that, it will continue to spread because people will start to see that, you're making a mark, that you're not in the doctor's office the whole time. You're out traveling and seeing the world and enjoying life and are grateful and are happy and are energetic, and more people will want to be that way. But I think that the big message is not that we're doomed or that it's a vicious cycle and we can't, we're too small of a voice. But just the opposite of that is that we're on a great path and it's only going to get better. And when people make comments, and the little snide remarks, it's really because they know the truth. And stick to your guns and continue to do what's right and get the exercise and you know, continue to move on your path of getting better. You can achieve the normal BMI. We know what humans should weigh, so you can get there. Don't sell yourself less. You have to say, I am there, I will be there, until you get there, because you will be there. So it's positive talk. I can't, won't make it, but I can, will certainly make it. So, you know, continue to choose the food, refine your diet, eating more colorful, eating the good things, and you actually will get there. Set lofty goals for your exercise. I certainly am. I saw a 71-year-old Asian woman, I'm coming for you. She set a world record in the marathon at 71. I can't remember the time, but it was really fast. I'm coming. Maybe it'll take me to 72, but I'm coming. I'm going to keep practicing, and I'm going to keep running. And I'm going to keep moving. And so I feel that every day I continue to get a little bit better. And so don't set the bar low. Don't be satisfied for what you have. Continue to push it a little bit further. So this podcast is a little quicker than the usual one once a week because I was off kilter from traveling. So I'm going to end it up here a little bit short. I'm going to be talking at our local bookstore called the Copperfish Bookstore in Punta Gorda on August 21st. If you're in town, stop by and see me. I'm going to be in Naples, Florida at the Naples Green Scene Meetup. You can go online and find, have it posted on the website. If you want to come to a book signing down in Naples, Florida, love to meet you down there. You can go on Amazon and get the book. I'll have it listed in the show notes. If you haven't got our Whole Food Plant-Based Wellness Cookbook, The Doctor, the Diva, and the Dietitian. Addie Delaney Meinrich, my registered dietitian and daughter, is in Houston. She does our dietary consultations either when she's here or on the phone or telemedicine. Or Zoom-type calls. She is available for you anywhere you are for a private consultation as well. So you can get in touch with us to find out more about that. We have three different ways to become a member of our practice. There's two online versions, one with Addie only, one with myself and Addie, that we speak to you once a month and talk about anything you want to talk about and go over any tests that you want to go over. And you have access to all our online material and what goes on in the class and extra newsletters. And then you can be a full member anywhere you are as well and have access to us all the time. We walk the walk and we treat our members like they're our family, and they are. We enjoy getting to know each and every one of them. We don't do things to them that we wouldn't have done to ourselves, and we don't do things to them just to do things to them. And we do, we push them. We want, as a group, all of us to strive to be as good as we can. So hop on over to our website, drdelaney.com, drdulaney, and check it out. Hope to see you at one of the book signings. Game Changers is coming out September 16th. You should check that movie out where you are locally. It's great for kids and people that are interested in athletics to see just how plant-based nutrition is going to make athletic performance better. I'm certainly a believer in it. Thank you for the email questions that people sent in. I appreciate them and love to address anything. So feel free to email me at jamie@drdelaney.com, jami@drdelaney.com. And a shout out to Cynthia. Good night, Cynthia. She listens to the podcast before she goes to bed. I hope you did your exercises. Have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you soon.